This episode is supported in part by the Center for Environmental Law at Loyola University, New Orleans, advocating for healthy communities and a sustainable Gulf Coast.
Welcome to CPR's Connect the Dots, a podcast produced by the Center for Progressive Reform, with your host, Rob Virchik.
Hey, y'all like frozen pizza? Did you know that the last frozen pizza that you ate, if it was in the United States, was regulated by 12 different federal agencies? Hey, can you name them? FDA, right? Food and Drug Administration. Don't worry. I got the rest for you. I'll tell you later on. I had to look them up too. So we're going to be talking about all those federal agencies today and more. It's the topic of a book called Reorganizing Government, A Functional and Dimensional Framework. It's a book by Alex Camacho and Rob Glicksman. And they're going to help us talk about how you design government and make it work right. We're going to talk about pizza. We're going to talk about emergency response and climate change and other big challenges. Well, I just want to acknowledge that this is the third season now of CPR's Connect the Dots. And I am just so happy to continue to be doing this and to have listeners like you following along. You know that the Center for Progressive Reform is mainly a network of scholars from all over the country. We're some of the best progressive legal and policy experts in the country at universities in almost every region. And hey, we are doing the unthinkable. We are giving our time away. And by that, I mean, we are donating our research, our work, our advocacy skills through the Center for Progressive Reform, along with a super professional staff that we have, in order to help communities all over the country do the right thing to protect their water, their food, their air, the workplaces, and everything else that are important to people to live just and healthy lives. And we've been doing a lot of different things recently. We've been working with federal lawmakers to develop ideas to bring renewables faster into the U.S. economy. We have been working with communities in Virginia to make communities safer from the dangers of toxic floodwaters, for instance. And we've been helping some states enforce their worker safety laws more strongly in order to keep people healthy and safe. I hope you'll check out what we do on our website, www.progressivereform.org. You can sign up to get our e-newsletter, find out what we're doing, and of course, you can keep on listening to this podcast and telling your friends and colleagues about it too. But the most important thing that you can do is think about the different topics in your own life that you care about that are related to government. It might be the environment, it might be the workplace, it might be the food you eat or something else. Watch those stories in the news, pay attention to them, and try yourself to connect the dots between what it is that folks are doing in government and what it is that you're experiencing and your neighbors and family are experiencing on the ground. How can you make the world a better place? Now let's move on to the main event. My guests today are two longtime scholars at CPR. They've written a book that has just come out called Reorganizing Government, A Functional and Dimensional Framework. It's a book about government effectiveness that's of interest not only to experts in the field or to policymakers, but to everyday readers too. I caught up with them a couple of weeks ago on a web-based conference line. Here's the interview. Alex Camacho and Rob Glicksman, welcome to Connect the Dots.
Thanks for having us. It's a pleasure.
Yes, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
I have to tell you that your book, Reorganizing Government, was a fascinating read for me. I found it really accessible. I learned an awful lot that I didn't know before about the history of some of these agencies. And I think you have really strong insights about the positive power of government. What I love about this book, as I was thinking about it more, is that it's really a book about good design. And design is really important. I mean, we study design, you know, of course, when it comes to cars or, you know, computer operating systems or chairs, even office staplers. And we care about design because it's a way to make things more efficient, easy to use, more effective, and sometimes for people who do it particularly well, even elegant. Government is just so much more important than an office stapler, but we don't really talk about design in that way so much when we're talking about government. And you really are moving us forward in that direction and saying, hey, let's look at agencies, particularly in the executive branch of government, an area where there's a broad canvas. The legislative branch is pretty much organized, in a way that we're all familiar with, as is the court system. But there's a big canvas in the executive branch, and the design plays a really big role. And so you talk about rules of design, and then you bring in some of this really interesting work that you've done over the years on food safety and environmental protection and climate action and bank regulation and all of that. And I want to get to those rules of design that you bring up. But the first thing that I have to ask you is there's this wonderful illustration early in the book of a pizza. And you say in this book, that when I go to the store and get my frozen Red Baron pizza, that it has already been regulated by at least 12 different agencies. And I can hear you flipping the pages right now to get to that pizza. And so the question, I mean, I'm looking at this and I'm thinking 12 different agencies, my frozen Red Baron pizza, we must have the safest pizza in the world. Rob Glicksman, why do we do it that way to begin with? Why is my pizza regulated by 12 different agencies?
I think it's mostly a matter of historical accident that agencies developed and were given authority to do certain things over time. And once they got that authority, became entrenched, they held on to it for dear life. The congressional committees that had oversight over the relevant agencies were reluctant to give it up. And so when something went wrong, I think Congress, in most instances, simply decided, well, let's create a new agency or give another agency authority to deal with this to sort of fix the problem that exists, rather than sort of rationally looking at the way the system had developed over time and thought about, well, is this the best approach or should we redesign this in ways that are more likely to result in a safe and healthy food supply for the country.
So if I get a pizza and it's got pepperoni on it and it's got, let's say, some vegetables, right? Green pepper, whatever. And then it's got cheese and whatever. God knows what else is on a Red Baron pizza. Can you walk me through sort of what the 12 agencies are doing to make sure that my pizza is safe?
Well, there are different things that go into a pizza. Some of them involve inputs. Some of them involve activities that take place on farms that are creating the components of a pizza. Some of them are involved in the processing of the ingredients to create a pizza. And sometimes there are multiple levels of processing. And the way the system is set up, different agencies tend to be in charge of overseeing and enforcing the laws that apply to each of those different levels of activity that winds up creating the pizza that you stick in your oven or buy from the supermarket. So in order to grow vegetables, you want to have green peppers or onions on your pizza. They need to be grown. And sometimes farmers apply chemical pesticides to try and keep the bugs away from the green peppers.
Yeah.
And so EPA has a hand in deciding which kind of pesticides can be used in which ways. A different agency, which is part of the Department of Agriculture, is in charge of regulating the kinds of seeds that can be used to produce certain kinds of vegetables. If you're talking about pepperoni or hamburger meat, you need to get that from animals, and the animals have to be reared before they're slaughtered. And yet another agency, the FDA, is in charge of overseeing the growth and maintenance of the animals and the ways in which they're slaughtered. And a similar allocation of authority among multiple agencies exists at the different processing levels as well.
And I guess we have transportation and things like that, too. If we're talking about something frozen, it has to be maintained and in a certain way.
You're likely to have yet additional regulation at the state level for the way that supermarkets handle the food that they purchase and then resell to consumers. So you've got agencies at all levels within the federal government and between the federal and state governments.
And they're all doing, I mean, a point that you make that I think is really useful is they're all doing different things in a way, or I should say maybe this way, the agencies are they're doing different kinds of functions, right? As you say, some of these functions might be licensing functions, like deciding what kind of a pesticide can be used when one is growing green peppers, and another function might be monitoring slaughterhouses to make sure that that hamburger is being produced eventually in the right way. And there might be standards that are set about how meat has to be handled or how cheese has to be processed, and those standards based on science and the economics of the industry and those things, those standards might come from a different agency.
Right. And I think
yeah, go ahead. What do we learn from that?
Well, I think when anybody sees this diagram and when they hear Rob sort of describe the different federal agencies that are involved in the process of creating a pizza, it's understandable that a lot of the common response to that would be, my goodness, that's a lot of agencies, and what should we do? We should just stick them all in one agency, and that the solution has to be just have one food agency that takes care of everything, soup to nuts. And I think that, you know, it's understandable that people have that reaction, but I think that for us, that also reveals a big part of the problem that people contribute to in policymakers in particular in trying to devise good regulatory design. Because as Rob was going through those different categories and as you sort of implied there, these agencies often do different things, and it's not irrational to say agency A, you should do this thing, function one, and agency B, you should do function two. And if you each have them doing something different, it's not necessarily inefficient, and you actually might get some real advantages from having different agencies doing specific things because of the particular expertise that they might have. The problem becomes when it's developed more haphazardly, as Rob had mentioned, you end up sometimes with agencies that have overlapping authority, where it doesn't have advantages or it creates problems from having that overlapping authority, or when the policymakers, when they create the allocation, aren't really thinking about the extent that the authority overlaps, the extent that there's coordination, or the extent that it's centralized or decentralized. So it's not surprising when you look at the history of the development of federal food safety regulation that you see that the most common reaction to the multiple agency authority is to consolidate, to create one agency, and to actually characterize it's very decentralized. The authority is very decentralized. And in fact, there are some functions that are decentralized, but there are other functions that are centralized, and that there are trade-offs from having some centralized and decentralized. And so I think we do, hopefully, a good job at sort of teasing those different functions apart and explaining, well, it may make sense to centralize some of these functions and consolidate, and it neither makes sense to do it for all functions, as well as it's not politically feasible to do it for all functions.
Well, so let me ask you this. Sorry to interrupt, Alex.
No, of course.
But this is great. So, and I want to stay with the pizza for a second, right? Because it's an easy thing, I think, for a lot of people to relate to. You make this argument about what I'm calling design. You call reorganization or organization, And I kind of see it as you describe it, which I think is really helpful, is there are maybe three kinds of sliding scales, right? There's one slider that goes between what you just talked about, centralized authority and decentralized authority. And then you can have all kinds of gradations in between. And then there's another slider that goes between overlapping, like you were talking about, authorities that have overlapping jurisdictions, and then authorities that just have very distinct jurisdictions. And then you've got a third slider that is this authority going to be independent from all other authorities, or are they going to work together with other authorities and be coordinated in some way? So you got this centralization, decentralization, distinct, overlapping, and then independent, coordinated. And you have some great graphics in there. It really helped me figure this out, I have to say. But so just let's just take centralization and decentralization. What are the things that might be good from a design point of view if you are interested in food protection, whether it's a pizza or anything else? What are the things that make sense to have centralized?
I think you would want to have certain functions centralized. Perhaps information distribution. So the Center for Disease Control is an agency that, among other things, has been charged with some responsibility for providing information about food safety hazards, contaminated lettuce, let's say, or other kinds of food. And it doesn't seem to make sense to have multiple agencies disseminating the same information. It's much more efficient to have a single agency doing that. So for that function, it seems to us centralization makes sense.
Because you get the best information, and then people also know who to listen to, right? They say, oh, well, it's the FDA saying this, so they're the ones I trust. Is that
right?
The
idea? Right. It develops a reputation for being an expert in that area and for having the best information. But there are other functions that I think would more profitably be centralized. So suppose you're concerned about safety problems that arise from microbial contamination, so
right,
contaminated lettuce with bacteria. But you might also be concerned that the pesticides that were applied to grow that lettuce are not safe. Over time, EPA has developed expertise in the risks that are created by exposure to chemical pesticides, whereas other agencies like FDA, USDA, are more familiar dealing with bacterial contamination. So that might be a situation where you want to decentralize authority to set standards for what safe food is to the two different sets of agencies, because EPA has more expertise in one area and FDA or USDA has more authority in the other.
Okay. So so how would that work, let's say, on distinct and overlapping?
Well, one of the functions that we often recommend in the book be allocated in overlapping fashion is standard setting, and another is enforcement. And the main benefit of creating overlapping authority for those two functions is a desire to create a safety net, so that in the event that one agency doesn't do a good enough job enforcing standards or adopts weak standards that aren't adequately protective of the public health, you've got another agency waiting in the wings that has the authority to supplement those efforts by engaging in its own enforcement or standard setting efforts. And so we think that at least in certain components of food safety regulation, that overlapping approach would make sense, especially if you're concerned that one agency might be vulnerable to capture by powerful economic interests like farmers or pesticide manufacturers.
Oh, right. So you might have two cops on the beat in a way.
Exactly.
Right.
I think in some ways that sort of the overlap distinct dimension really we think is an important contribution to the thinking about regulatory design, because over and over again, certainly in the food safety context, but in other contexts as well, policymakers and scholars, even when they're thinking about how to address, the ones that do think about sort of how to allocate authority, they will often think about the choice being between a centralized authority or a decentralized authority, and sort of not really think about the fact that there are advantages to having two authorities, and there are also disadvantages to having two authorities together. But that is a different choice than whether that authority should be, you know, at a more centralized scale or a more decentralized scale. There are advantages, disadvantages. And so what Rob was sort of identifying was, you know, sometimes there's an advantage to having multiple, as you said, cops on the beat, multiple locks on the door. There are costs to that. Having multiple locks on a door does cost more. And sometimes it's a pain in the butt to have multiple locks. You have to open, you know, each lock.
Yeah, yeah.
But there are advantages to it. And so as well, it's a different question than whether it should be a centralized or decentralized. And unfortunately, policymakers routinely forget to think about that aspect when doing it.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because the first thing I thought, right, which is what you're talking about here, is that sometimes when the stakes are really high, that's when you think that redundancy is a good idea. Right. You know, so that's why you have anti-lock brakes and seat belts and airbags in a car, right? And down here, I'm in New Orleans, and I write and think a lot about disaster, and I'm going to ask you about that in a second, you know, but that's important. I'm writing right now about power grids and thinking a lot about power grids and disaster. And so I want to have a smart grid system that makes sure that when your electricity is failing, that the last electricity goes to the hospital, right? Because that's more important, and you avoid catastrophe that way. And then if all of the power fails, well, then you want to make sure the hospital has a diesel-powered freestanding generator, and which is the second layer. And then you also want to make sure that your generator is not in the basement, that it's on the second floor on risers or whatever it is. And that's a third layer. And the reason you go through all this trouble is because it's really, really bad when people are dying in the hospital because there's no electricity, or, you know, in their cars or eating food that's where there's been an outbreak of something. And FEMA, I want to talk to you about, because you bring it up in the introduction. I think it's a really great example of, it seems like one of these agencies that has been reorganized several times and been taken in and out of different departments, reassembled. And I suspect that the reason is because we really care about catastrophic failures, and those catastrophic failures, when FEMA is involved, show up on television every day for a week or whatever it is. So can you tell us a little bit about the evolution of FEMA? I mean, and is there any, I mean, you're really going to help me with this one. Is there any rhyme or reason to how FEMA has evolved? And do you think it's in a good place?
Sure. I don't think there's any rhyme or reason. I think this is an example of two common mistakes that policymakers have made in a whole variety of contexts. One of them is that they tend to focus on reallocating authority when problems are identified and a desire is to fix things. They focus on one of the three dimensions that you described a few minutes ago, Rob, rather than thinking about whether or not it makes more sense to move the dial or slide the scale on a different dimension. The other mistake they made is that even if they think they're focusing on more than one dimension, they often confuse the dimensions, so that they identify a problem along one dimension but adopt a solution along a different dimension.
So, like, what's an example of that?
FEMA, as you mentioned, quite a few of the different reallocations seem to have been to centralize or decentralize. So in the 70s, it was centralized, and then Nixon decentralized it. And then in 79, Carter centralized it. And then that prompted a reorganization in 93 that led to sort of dividing up the authority. And then there were the terrorist attacks of 9/11, which then eventually led to consolidating FEMA into the Department of Homeland Security. So you end up with its movements along centralization, decentralization. But as the book points out, you know, most of the critiques of what was going on with FEMA or disaster preparedness at the federal government level was about coordination, inadequate coordination. And instead of trying to enhance agency coordination, the changes kept moving along the centralization, decentralization.
But now wait a minute. Now, can't you, though, say, well, when things are centralized, they're likely to be better coordinated?
Not necessarily.
Okay, so tell me why. Tell me why.
Well, and a good example would be the Department of Homeland Security, which also arose in the wake of 9/11. We'll get back to the FEMA example, but
yeah.
But to answer your question, the concerns that arose from 9/11 was that various intelligence gathering agencies were not talking to each other, weren't coordinating, weren't sharing information in ways that would have facilitated the government's ability to identify terrorist threats before damage occurred. And so the solution that Congress settled on was to create this new agency, the Department of Homeland Security, which was formed by consolidating 20 plus different agencies into this larger agency.
Right.
And one might have thought that would have addressed some of the problems of lack of coordination. But it turned out that the new agency was unwieldy. It was so huge that you had to create subdivisions and mini agencies within the agency, and they didn't talk to each other either. And so you simply replicated the lack of coordination in a different regulatory structure rather than solving it.
You know what this reminds me of? I have to say, so as you know, I worked at the EPA for 2 years during the Obama administration in his first term. And a lot of what I did had to do with preparing for climate change, which is something I know we're going to talk about later in the show. And I was at one of these interagency meetings, you know, representing the EPA. And there were a lot of other agencies there that were all involved in preparing for climate change, reducing risks of flood and those kinds of things. And I was sitting next to a guy who was, he was a sort of a higher up official, whatever, in DHS, in Homeland Security. And we were just talking before the meeting, and he said to me, I'm still trying to figure out how I got into this meeting. And I said, well, what do you mean? It's a meeting about avoiding floods and flood management and climate change preparation. And he said, yeah, but that's not what my department does, Homeland Security. And I said, oh, what does your department do? He says, well, you know, this is actually what he said. He says, you know, we're looking for bad guys. He says, we're looking for bad guys and trying to keep them from hurting the United States. And that really struck me because he obviously wasn't affiliated with FEMA, but FEMA was in his department and it was organized in a way that FEMA was not something, nor were natural disasters something that he regularly thought about in his work, although I'm sure he was doing very good work and very talented and all of this. But it just seemed that, like you say, there was not a lot of coordination within the Department of Homeland.
I think the sort of the stark way of pointing it out, really about why we think of these as different dimensions, is that you can have decentralized but coordinated authority, and you can have centralized and uncoordinated authority. And so they are different aspects that, of course, you know, sometimes more centralized authorities do have the ability to coordinate a little more easily. You can have, and Homeland Security happens to be an example of a centralized, uncoordinated authority. But solving the problem of lack of coordination is rarely going to be useful to be increasing centralization or moving along to centralization, decentralization.
So how would you fix? I mean, we're not going to fix all of FEMA, God knows, right? But in this conversation, but what would be some quick points of weakness that you think should be addressed?
Well, I think one of the problems with incorporating FEMA into DHS, as you point out, Rob, is that DHS's mission, as conceived of by the agency's leaders, was identifying bad guys. And FEMA's mission historically was disaster, and it was subordinated to the let's catch bad guys mission. And so I think attention wasn't paid to the disaster management aspect of this new sub-agency within DHS.
Right.
Funds weren't allocated to it. And I think the agency's effectiveness suffered critically as a result. And so I think one option would be to either mandate that FEMA be given the authority and the resources it needs to do an effective job, or to move FEMA out of DHS and restore its mission-oriented focus on disaster management.
Yeah, that's a really good point about funding, too, because you might imagine, well, if Congress is looking at the budget for Homeland Security, they might just say, oh, well, the money goes to Homeland Security and then it funnels down through there. But then you don't have dedicated funding streams necessarily going to things that you really care about.
Well, I think it also, we didn't really talk about, so the story of FEMA involving sort of centralization and decentralization, you might ask, well, why the heck do they keep decentralizing?
Yeah,
right. There's a lack of coordination. Well, you know, I think it's important to point out, this is somewhat what's being highlighted by Rob's sort of suggestion, is that there are advantages to having decentralized authority. Namely, in this context, FEMA presumably are experts on disaster preparation, and having them be in charge and sort of separated out from different agencies with that core goal is valuable.
Yeah.
It has that sort of benefit of expertise. So there's sort of the push and pull is we like the individualized expertise, but then there's lack of coordination. So let's consolidate them. And, you know, if the real problem is we enjoy the expertise, we think that having that ability to decentralize and allow for tailored approaches, it has value. Well, you don't want to consolidate because you're going to lose that. But you can increase coordination of certain functions of the agencies in order to make sure that you sort of tamper down the problems of lack of coordination, lack of harmonization or inconsistency or even agency competition by promoting coordination between the agencies on key aspects where you're worried about that problem.
Well, Alex, let me ask you a little bit about the coordination part, and I'll get Rob in too on this. Because I know that in your book, you have this great chapter on environmental review, right, which are these all of the processes that sometimes lead to environmental impact statements, which are required under statutory law for large projects, either funded or implemented by the federal government that might have significant impacts on the human environment. And so we have this environmental review process, we have the environmental impact statements, we have a lot of agencies that all have to coordinate in order to produce these environmental impact statements. And of course, this law and these reviews have done an awful lot of good. And all of us in this discussion have written about the importance of that. But the other thing that we have to say is that these environmental reviews take a long, long time. And of course, they're not perfect. And so I guess I know, Alex, you've written about this in particular, and so that's why I'm asking you, but what is it about the environmental review process that requires so much, I'll say, kibitzing among the agencies? And is it too much? Is it just the right amount? Or is there something we could learn about how better to coordinate agency review?
Well, that's great. So you're right. The National Environmental Policy Act does mandate coordinating of certain governmental functions, namely gathering information and planning between federal agencies. And, you know, most people, if they know about NEPA, think of it as sort of an information sort of a statute that requires a statement to be put out by an agency that's thinking of doing a certain project. But a key part of it is to say, not only do you have to agency that's thinking of doing something that might have an environmental impact, do some sort of environmental analysis of it, but you also have to consult with and get the comments from other agencies that have expertise. And a key aspect of that, of course, and this it's coordination, right? It's basically telling agencies you need to coordinate when you're planning and you're doing information gathering. And the reason for doing that isn't just that we think the environment matters, which of course it does, and that agencies might be ignoring environmental harms. But it also is a way to make sure that agencies that have expertise on certain parts of federal decision-making should be involved in that decision-making.
So let me just stop you there just for a second, because I'm going to imagine This is something I've worked on in the past. Imagine a pipeline, right? Let's say some kind of a pipeline that's going to produce a petroleum product, and it's got to go across the land. And so let's say it's going, from Canada to the United States. So that means that you're going to have the State Department involved, right? Because there's an international issue. If that pipeline is going to be on some kind of public land, whether it's BLM land or a forest, a national forest, whatever it is, then we're going to have the Department of Interior weighing in. It might might involve habitat of endangered species, so we might have to have Fish and Wildlife involved. We're certainly going to want to have the EPA involved because this is going to be producing a product that's going to be burned and contribute to climate change. And I'm just listing the obvious agencies that I can think of, right? So for somebody, I think, maybe trying to imagine this, who's listening, even putting together something like a pipeline, you are saying, would require lots of information that another agency doesn't have about the Canadian-U.S. relationship, about habitats for endangered species, about the cost of burning carbon, and so on. Am I sort of spelling that out in a way that is along what you're talking about?
Yes, definitely. I mean, basically, if you think of what NEPA is doing there is it's concerned about the environmental impacts, but it's also concerned about good governance. It's concerned about making sure that federal agencies with expertise and knowledge on something be involved in decisions that other agencies are making, and that's good government. Of course, good government also involves environmental protection. So NEPA does mandate coordination of certain functions, of namely information gathering and planning. Now, it doesn't require coordination on all kinds of government functions, right? It doesn't require that agencies implement projects together. So the pipeline that you're referring there, once the agency may get the requisite approvals from and go through the NEPA process, once it decides, okay, now we're going to go forward with the pipeline, first of all, that decision, it doesn't need to consult the other agencies for.
It can make the decision on its own without asking the other agencies.
Right. And then after that, you know, in any kind of post-decision monitoring, other agencies, certainly NEPA doesn't require that to occur. So I think when you raise the question about is there too much coordination, which is in some ways saying there's too much agencies involved, et cetera, in many ways, you know, NEPA's coordination has been assessed in a lot of different ways, as I'm sure both of you know, obviously, in lots of different studies about it. But most of that focus is always on, should you have more or less coordination in the planning process?
In the front end.
Right.
Yeah.
And very rarely is anybody talking about, what about other functions? Like, so what about, for example, information dissemination? So not the gathering of the information, but just, you know, making sure that other agencies have that information. Or an environmental impact statement, sort of the cornerstone document of NEPA. How do you make sure that other agencies and the public have access to past statements by other agencies? That doesn't exist. So there's no coordination of information dissemination. As you mentioned before, there's no coordination in implementation. And there's no coordination in the monitoring, you know, after the decision. So I think what we are suggesting is, you know, again, in thinking about the advantages and disadvantages of coordination, you know, first of all, people should be thinking about the advantages and advantages of coordination. But besides that, when you're thinking about the advantages and disadvantages, the advantages and disadvantages will vary depending on what function you're talking about. So I think the case for promoting coordination in the planning process and information gathering is very strong. All the evidence suggests that NEPA has been incredibly valuable in that regard. And of course, there are ways to promote, make it better, but that is an incredibly valuable place to have it. While there are, you know, I think reasonable minds might differ as to whether there should be coordination of implementation. For example, sometimes it does make sense for that pipeline agency who has expertise in building that pipeline, once they've talked to the other agencies and come up with measures to try to mitigate the harms of that pipeline, that agency should be the one that's in charge of implementation. So the point being that coordination isn't a single, it isn't it's contextual, and that there are sometimes some functions where it makes sense to do. And the trade-offs will differ depending on which function you're talking about.
One of the other points we make in the chapter in which we discuss NEPA is that it might be profitable to compare the way NEPA operates with other statutes where there is required coordination in some of these back-end functions that we think NEPA gives little weight to. So NEPA documents are basically predictive judgments. Here's what we're proposing, and we think it will have these environmental effects. And we gather information from other agencies that have expertise to help us make our predictive judgments. But then the agency goes ahead and decides to implement the project. Are the predictions going to be borne out? It would make sense to require the agency to check to make sure that things worked out the way that the agency thought they would.
Yeah.
Because if they didn't, then you might want to have some follow-up to sort of change the way the things that are approved operate to minimize environmental effects. We think that the Endangered Species Act does, for example, a somewhat better job in ensuring that sort of back-end monitoring and reevaluation than NEPA does. And so in response to your question, Rob, earlier, is there too much coordination? I think Alex made this point as well. In some respects, we think there's not enough.
Right.
We think that the ESA might provide a model for enhancing coordination with respect to different functions than the ones that NEPA focuses on.
Well, so help us figure that out. So let me just stick with the pipeline for a second then. So, because we all teach, I think, this area of environmental review in various classes. And so when I teach about NEPA, the law that requires this environmental review, and we take a look at maybe a case that has to do with a pipeline, and the agency approving the pipeline might say something like, we think that the risk of the pipeline breaking and contaminating an underground water supply, we think that that risk is very, very minimal, and therefore we're not very concerned about it, right? And then inevitably, I'll have a student will say, well, it's 10 years later, did that pipeline ever breach, and did it ever affect the water table in some significant way? And often the answer, as you know, is we don't know, or somebody knows, but it's really hard to find out what the answer is because there's nobody, as Alex says, who's been monitoring it and then sharing the information with the other agencies and that. So, okay, so that's an example of that not happening. So Rob, using the Endangered Species Act, where you sometimes have to get permits to do certain things on land that might affect endangered species, you're saying that that there is more follow-up, which of course there is. And I'm wondering if you can kind of spell out what that process is and how that might be something that we could use in the NEPA process too.
Well, the main difference, of course, between the Endangered Species Act and NEPA is that there's a substantive component to the Endangered Species Act that we don't have in NEPA.
Yeah,
so agencies are subject to an ongoing responsibility to make sure that things that they do or finance or approve don't jeopardize the continued existence of endangered species or interfere with the critical habitat of such species. And so that ongoing obligation, I think, creates a duty on the part of the agency to follow up not be satisfied with the initial take, the initial evaluation of what the likely effects of the project would be. Since NEPA doesn't have that independent substantive component, and if Congress isn't willing to supply it, at least one ought to require agencies to engage in post-approval monitoring and disseminate that information to the agencies that provided input the first time around.
And they could do that without a congressional directive, you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, CEQ, the Council on Environmental Quality, which is the agency charged with overseeing compliance with NEPA by other agencies, could, by regulation, impose some requirements that agencies follow up and gather the information needed to see whether things turned out the way they thought they would.
Right. And if one wanted to be pragmatic and sort of like making the case for why it's valuable, I think all three of us think it's valuable on its own. But it certainly can't, again, using our framework, it's possible. I think it's a very strong argument to say, look, for those of you who are worried about the NEPA front-end process taking too long and involving too much time, one way to manage that problem is to make sure that, you still want to have front-end coordination. But rather than trying to jam it all at the very beginning, have some of that at the beginning, know that there are some gaps of knowledge and lack of information and uncertainties at the initial planning stage, but build into the process later on the ability to look at the decision and maybe adjust it over time. That process of increasing the coordination later on in the regulatory process, but maybe lessening a little bit, but having a little bit less of that coordination function early on can long term have a much better lead to much better government and decision making than just trying to jam everything at the beginning.
Yeah. Now, Alex. Go ahead, Rob. Go ahead.
I was going to say, and the information you get by that reallocation of coordination responsibilities might actually be better information, because at the front end, as I said, the agency is making predictive judgments, and sometimes it's just not possible to predict accurately what the effects of an action will be, and so you're kind of speculating, and if that's the end of your responsibility, that's not a really solid informational basis upon which to govern. But if you're gathering information on the back end, you're looking at the way things have actually turned out. You've got a lot more information that's based in reality. And at least in some cases, you might be able to make better informed policy choices based upon that enhanced information base.
So remember that pizza and all the agencies involved? There's a government study attributing regulation of frozen pizza to at least six main agencies, and then based on information in Glicksman and Camacho's book, there are at least six other agencies that would play some tangential role. So here they are. The FDA, we knew that. The EPA, the Food Safety and Inspection Service. The Agricultural Marketing Service, the Animal Plant and Health Inspector Service, the Grain Inspection Packers and Stockyard Administration, that's my favorite, the National Agricultural Statistics Service, the Agricultural Research Service, the Economic Research Service, the Centers for Disease Control, the Federal Trade Commission, and if you like anchovies on your pizza, the National Marine Fisheries Service. Now back to the interview. It sounds like, Rob, where you're going, and Alex, I know you've written about this, right, is about how to design government in a way that learns from its previous behavior, so that if something works, then you write it down and you say, well, this worked. We can make these assumptions again.
Right.
And if something doesn't work, you can say, oh, well, we made the wrong assumptions. Let's
sure.
not make those wrong assumptions again. And that makes me think, obviously, at least to us, I suppose, about climate change, because climate change is one of those things where there are lots of uncertainties, not only in terms of the sensitivity of the planet to heat and temperature, but you know, to the rate at which sea levels are going to rise, and all of this. And all three of us, I know, have written about policies having to do with climate, and argued in one way or another that government has to be nimble. It has to be able to learn as it acts and behaves, because we just don't know enough about climate to know exactly what the right answer should be in systems. So I want to get us into climate, but I just want to take a point to just state some things that you state very succinctly in your chapter about climate for our listeners. I sometimes talk about climate action, meaning all types of government work that addresses climate, but you could split it up into three different things. And your point in your book, which I think is really helpful, is that these three things, ways to address climate, might require different designs. And so one thing that we think of when we think of climate action is reducing carbon, that is reducing greenhouse gases that actually contribute to climate change. And that's what we spend a lot of time thinking about and reading about in the news and so on. So there's, we call it mitigation sometimes, reducing carbon. The second thing is preparing for climate change. So if the first thing is reducing the risks that we can't manage, the second thing is managing the risks that we can't reduce, that we can't avoid. And so that's adapting to the climate that's already baked in the system. And we call that adaptation sometimes. And then the third thing, which to me is really scary, but I've started to learn more about it and to study it, as you have, which is geoengineering, this idea of actually trying to control the climate by putting aerosols or water droplets or vapors or nanoparticles or whatever it is, putting these things up in the atmosphere in a way to deflect the sunlight and to control the shading of the planet, you know, a kind of technological way of hacking the climate system so that you can control the thermostat. So we've got reducing carbon, we've got adapting to climate change, and we've got geoengineering, hacking the climate. Either one of you, take a shot at telling me about what a good design principle is for reducing carbon, the first part.
I think our book takes the point of view that we have to look at these three aspects of climate change differently, and the different allocations of authority are likely to be best suited to the three different kinds of climate action. And so for mitigation, we're talking about strategies that are designed to provide environmental benefits, some of which may be global, some of which may be local, but that are likely to generate economic harms that are localized. And so the nature of the problems being addressed and the nature of the resulting consequences, I think, are useful to think about it in designing appropriate regulatory structures. For greenhouse gas mitigation, we think it's important to have a strong centralized standard setting role, because otherwise, if you left this, let's say, to the states primarily, the tendency would be for each state to say, well, climate change is a global problem. A greenhouse gas that's emitted here has the same effect on the climate as greenhouse gas emissions in China or Siberia or anywhere else.
Right.
So why should we go to the trouble of reducing our emissions? Let's hope that others do so, and we will get the benefits of their having done so.
They're free riders.
That's right.
They don't want to spend the cost because the cost is local and the benefits go to everybody. Right.
So we think that that's a reason to institute a system in which there's centralized standard setting so that everybody basically has to do their fair share of mitigating greenhouse gas emissions. So that's, I think, one component of the design that we suggest for mitigation. Another component would be to create overlapping authority for significant functions in order to take advantage of the safety net advantages that overlapping authority can create.
Like seatbelts and airbags, something like that.
Like seatbelts and airbags, that's right.
Yeah.
So an example here would be, I think, to pull something from the news, the recent dispute over whether or not California should have the authority to impose more stringent tailpipe emission standards for greenhouse gases than EPA has seen fit to adopt. And historically, over the past 40 years or so, California has been given significant discretion to adopt standards that are more stringent than EPA's in light of, first of all, California's historic leadership in clean air regulation generally and climate change in particular. And second, to recognize the fact that California has had more persistent, serious air pollution problems than other parts of the country have had. And so we give California uniquely the authority to adopt additional standards in case EPA doesn't do enough to address the problem. Well, what EPA is in the process of doing now is twofold. Number one, they propose to revoke standards adopted by the Obama administration that would tighten up on the degree to which auto manufacturers need to manufacture fuel-efficient cars that don't generate a lot of greenhouse gas emissions. And on the other hand, they're trying to revoke California's authority to adopt more stringent standards. So you get the worst of both worlds.
Yeah, exactly.
And so we think overlapping authority makes a lot of sense here to deal with precisely the situation we're in now, where EPA is backtracking and weakening climate controls. And that's precisely the situation in which it's important to have a backup mechanism, in this case, state regulatory authority to provide a safety net.
Right. So we're back to two cops on the beat again. So how does this work for adaptation then, Alex? Is it a different mix, right?
It's a different problem. So the allocation of authority should be different. And of course, even for mitigation, you would make allocations of authority differently for certain functions. You might make a more independent certain exercises of authority, and then other ones more coordinated. But in adaptation, so mitigation, the problem is the local governments lack the incentive to act, or at least some local governments or states lack the incentive to act. So when you've got that system having centralized standard setting, but with some overlap for the redundancy benefits, makes a lot of sense. Adaptation involves, the core problem are what, economists, more wonky people would say are cross-jurisdictional externalities, right? What they mean by that is that you end up with lots of local benefits and harms. The strategies for adapting to climate change tend to be deployed locally, but they largely involve local benefits and local harms.
Right.
And there's the other sort of characteristic of the adaptation problem is that there's a lot of uncertainty regarding mitigation as well. But in adaptation, trying to figure out what are the effects going to be at a very local level, what they call downscaling the effects, is often – it's getting better every year, but still there's a lot of uncertainty. So given that those characteristics of the problem, a lot of uncertainty, benefits tend to be very local, and the harms tend to be very local, that tends to suggest an allocation of authority that involves – pretty decentralized authorities. You get the expertise benefits of decentralization.
I was just going to say, I think is like spot on. And in New Orleans, we live this every day. And so one of the things that we care an awful lot about right now, all the politicians, is stormwater management, right? Which is a big issue when we have heavy rain events, which are influenced by climate change, perhaps, and so on. And of course, we're willing to spend some money as a city locally, because if we can control our stormwater, we preserve our property values and public safety and these kinds of things. But here's the kicker, though, Alex and Rob, mm-hmm. is that the kind of work that we're doing down here in New Orleans, and some of it is experimental, right? Some of it is like, well, mm-hmm. we're doing old style things in some places where we're using these underground canals, essentially moving water around. And then sometimes we're doing really innovative things, like trying to use rain gardens and different kinds of swales in the landscape architecture to control water. For promising effect. And we're learning from that, right? Because we have an incentive mm-hmm. to learn from that and record what's happening. And so we can use that technology again. But I guess the issue that I had is that all of this stuff is really expensive. I mean, it cost mm-hmm. us $1 billion to redo our stormwater system after Hurricane Katrina. So that strikes me as something that no city can pay right. for on its own, right? And
right.
so how do we justify that, and where does that fit in your sure. design framework?
That's great. So I think that's right. So the idea is the problem is mostly local benefits and mostly local harms. There are real advantages to making the decision at the local level because of the expertise, because as you mentioned, some of the learning and experimentation that can occur at a local level, and the fact that local areas tend to be very different. California yeah. is very different than Maryland, very different than Louisiana. So the problems are different. So it makes a lot of sense to have decentralized authority. However, for some functions, like you mentioned, for funding or other functions like disseminating information. So what the heck is New Orleans doing, and how can California, how can Los Angeles learn
yes.
from that, and how can Washington, D.C. learn from that, and vice versa? So funding, information dissemination, certain kinds of functions, it makes sense to centralize. And of course, there are some, I mentioned that most of the benefits and harms tend to be local, but it's not all local. I mean, there are certainly things that Louisiana can do that are going to have effects on Mississippi and that are going to have effects on Florida and so forth. So sometimes having mechanisms that involve interjurisdictional coordination to make sure that certain activities manage, so certain strategies that help manage those sort of cross-jurisdiction effects are very important too. So separating it compared to mitigation, which has the standards fairly centralized, but a lot of the implementation to be more localized. Adaptation tends to be primarily, we think, for most functions, fairly decentralized, but for some key functions to have them centralized, and of course, for certain, even if the authority is mostly decentralized, to require some sort of inter-jurisdiction coordination, and of course have a role for the federal government in gathering funding, in gathering information, and of course making sure that local, you know, strategies do not have disproportionate effects on other local governments or other states.
Right, which could happen, right, if you're talking about a large levee project, mm-hmm. for instance, mm-hmm. or something like that. Yeah, or coastal erosion.
That points out that there are, again, different justifications, advantages and disadvantages for each end of the three dimensions we discussed. So in this case, the advantage of centralizing certain functions is, number one, that it may be appropriate to do so if local actions can have spillover effects in other jurisdictions. And if that's the case, the only governmental entity that really has both the incentive and the capacity to do something to minimize those cross-jurisdictional effects is likely to be a centralized authority. Well, the other thing that emerged from what you were talking about, Rob, is that the capacity of the different levels of government ought to be a prominent concern in allocating authority. And so if Louisiana or New Orleans lacks the financial wherewithal to effectively adapt to climate change, it may need assistance from the federal government. So some centralized funding mechanism is likely appropriate.
So tell me, Rob, about geoengineering, which I'm just going to go out on a limb and say is the mother of all spillover effects, right? What can you just tell our listeners sort of what are we talking about when we're talking about geoengineering, and what, if anything, can we do to responsibly regulate it?
Well, I guess I would describe geoengineering as intentional messing with the climate. It's not that we're doing something that inadvertently interferes with climate mechanisms. We're intentionally going out and changing the way the climate operates because we think that we need to do that to avoid some of the worst effects of climate change. And so some of the mechanisms are more far-fetched than others. Some seem more like science fiction than reality. But for example, some people have proposed projecting particles of sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere because they will disperse and create kind of a shield that will bounce some of the solar radiation back into space instead of allowing it to hit the Earth, which would thereby minimize the degree to which the greenhouse effect occurs. Some people have suggested that we ought to shoot a series of mirrors up into space that would deflect some of the sun's radiation back into space. The problem with these proposals is, number one, we have no idea what effects they will have because we've never, thankfully,
we've never needed to try them.
Right. So if you talk about uncertainty, and that certainly exists in the area of adaptation, it's massive in the area of geoengineering. And the second thing is that any one individual, nation, company that decides to try out some of these techniques could wind up having a catastrophic effect everywhere in the world. And so those are the characteristics that I think are preeminent in deciding how to allocate authority.
Right.
We want to make sure that we've thought this through carefully and that we have a lot of fail-safes in place to make sure that no one is able to haphazardly go out and try something that they think will help them, but that winds up basically destroying the livelihoods and lifestyles of others. And that argues for a good deal of centralization and control over both research into and deployment of geoengineering. And here, I think we need centralization and a degree of coordination at the international level, not just at the state or national level.
So I would just add, so the nature of the problem, obviously, when you compare the three different areas, mitigation, the way the local governments lack the incentive to act, or the state lacks the incentive to act, adaptation, where they have both the benefits and the harms mostly, although there are some cross-jurisdictional problems, And in geoengineering, it's actually sort of the flip. Rather than the local area having lacking the incentive to act, some local areas will have a huge incentive to act because they're feeling the disproportionate effects of climate change, and they have the wherewithal to do it. So they will act, potentially will act in ways that will harm others because they will not experience, or because of the harms are so strong from not acting that they're willing to act. I would just add, in terms of like the framing for it, to me, the approach to dealing with geoengineering cries out not just for potentially some centralization and some coordination, but for overlap. And again, when we think about overlapping authority being one of the key benefits being redundancies, you want to make sure that at multiple levels of government that everybody is on board for deploying this technology. And so not only does it make sense to have a lot of these sort of functions like standard setting to be centralized, but also to have them overlapping. Not just the central government has to decide, but also, perhaps, more provincial governments do as well.
So this might be a coordinating effect as well. Mm-hmm. Maybe. I was at a workshop a while back on geoengineering and hearing some remarkable things. You could imagine a country in Asia wanting to increase its wanting to tamp down on temperatures in some ways, right? To cool things down. And in doing so, they might benefit themselves, but then they could literally for a year turn off the monsoon, right? That's responsible for farming in rural India or whatever. And as you say, millions of people's livelihoods and lives could be at stake. The other thing I learned at this workshop, I'll just point out, and you know this, but to me, it's quite remarkable. There really isn't much in terms of international law that affects how people can work on the environment. There's something called the Environmental Modification Convention, which you can look up on Wikipedia, and what you'll find out is, it's essentially a convention about prohibiting tampering with the weather for a military purpose or a hostile purpose. But a lot of the things we're talking about wouldn't necessarily, I think, be conceived of as military or hostile. And as you say, it's a country could do it, or even an individual, a well-heeled, genius billionaire could figure out, I guess, how to test it. Does this scare you?
Yes,
it scares the heck out of me.
But what you highlight, obviously, Rob, is that because it's a relatively, in some of these technologies, shooting satellites into space for mirrors is certainly requires a more financial wherewithal.
Yeah, I get
but
that.
An individual
yeah.
country might do that.
Yeah.
But certainly some of the technologies that might be possible. I mean, certainly weather modification is something that occurs currently.
Sure.
Cloud seeding and the like. It does suggest, you can imagine, and you mentioned somebody turning off the monsoon for a certain period of time, but you can imagine the sort of response of a country that has some wherewithal to do, go back and say, well, I'm going to double the monsoon, you could see how this might be something that could lead to an arms race of some sort. And so there's a lot of reason to be concerned. And I think that the challenge becomes, in that sense, I believe, in some ways, geoengineering is not that different than nuclear deployment, right? In the sense that an individual actor can do something that will have cascading effects globally.
Yeah.
Now, I think that makes geoengineering in some ways a little scarier is that, the wherewithal to alter the climate is in some sense potentially easier. So I think that's why Rob and I, when we think about the allocation of authority there, it's very different than it would make sense for mitigation and adaptation, where you want to have multiple levels of buy-in by at different levels to ensure, so both overlap and coordination, lots of redundancy, lots of checks to make sure that there's a safety net to prevent activities that are problematic, which is very different than what exists currently at the international level.
Right.
We don't have a framework like the Montreal Protocol, in which the nations got together and basically decided they were going to take a uniform approach to phasing out the use of ozone-depleting chemicals like chlorofluorocarbons.
Right.
That kind of mechanism is just entirely lacking with respect to geoengineering.
Right. So I want to bring us, I'm going to bring us back to Earth here, because we're almost at the end of our time. A lot of your book, which is on government design, it seems obvious what officials and agencies and what policymakers could get out of this book, because they're the ones who are in charge of designing government frameworks of one kind or another. But I think that your book implicitly is making the case that this kind of thinking about design is important for all residents and citizens in the United States to know something about. What's the best case that you can make? Why should voters, citizens, residents in the United States care about the design of government systems like this? And what can they do at an individual level or at a community level to actually realize some of the ideas that you are putting forth?
Let me start by addressing the first half of your question. And I think it brings to my mind the reasons why we wrote this book in the first place. And our initial spur to write the book was our sense that people are disgruntled, dissatisfied with government. And there's been quite a bit of criticism of government over the years, sometimes from the political right, sometimes from the political left. Government isn't doing this enough. It's doing too much of that. It's not doing the right thing. And there's been sort of a disaffection with government generally. And our sense is government is here to help people. And it has a critically important role to play in improving the way society works and improving people's lives. And we think that sometimes the reason that government hasn't worked as well as it might, or as well as we hoped, is that it's been poorly designed. And so our prescription is don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Instead of reaching the conclusion that government is no good, we should instead think about how we might improve the way the government operates through what we're calling institutional design, through thinking about the best ways to allocate authority among different government actors. And we think that our framework provides a promising approach for accomplishing exactly that, improving government and hopefully convincing people that support of government initiatives, regulation and otherwise, is something that will help them in their day-to-day lives.
Yeah, and I would just add that, you know, that I think the book definitely, it in some sense, it takes a long view. The idea that that the regulatory process doesn't have to be based purely on raw politics of promoting a particular sort of regulated entity's interests or promoting corporate interests, or on the other side, you know, any kind of what people might call sort of with a bad term, special interest politics. That the focus can be on reason giving, on assessing the advantages and the disadvantages, the trade-offs of different decisions. That regulation is not doesn't have to inherently be a process of interest, raw interest group politics. And that one way to try to make sure that that occurs is for us to be able to be talking intelligently about the different advantages and disadvantages of decision making, of allocations of authority.
Well put. Well put. Well, thank you. The book is called Reorganizing Government, a Functional and Dimensional Framework. Alex Camacho and Rob Glicksman, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me today on Connect the Dots.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show. Visit our show page to find more on my guests and the topics we discussed. That's at www.progressivereform.org. I'm always interested in your reactions to the show. And at the end of this season, I've decided that I'm going to devote a special episode just to the email I receive. So you have to send me good questions. Send me questions about anything related to health, safety, and the environment, or anything related to law and policy for that matter. And I promise I will get a guest or two on hand to answer those questions in a last episode. So write me. I'm at rob@progressivereform.org. Or you can follow me on Twitter and message me there at Rob Verchik, R-O-B, V as in Victor, E-R-C-H-I-C-K. Thanks again to the Center for Environmental Law at Loyola University, New Orleans. Our music today was performed by the Dubwegians. Our theme music, as always, was by Lobo Loco. Take care.
You've been listening to CPR's Connect the Dots, a podcast produced by the Center for Progressive Reform. We're a legal policy center working to build thriving communities on a resilient planet. Check us out and subscribe to our podcast by visiting our website at www.progressivereform.org. Thanks. See you there.